Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started. I'll call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you for being here bright and early on a Monday morning. What we're going to do is we're going to take a couple of the bills out of the agenda order because of just preference of who we have coming before us. We have some legislators who are supposed to be coming in. I also realize that some of these are going to go pretty quick. So I'm going to start with Senate Bill 912. Open a public hearing.
Yes, Chair Prezanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 912 is sponsored by the Committee on Judiciary. We don't have the paperwork back for this bill yet. We don't have any amendments before us today. So ownership of certain submerged and submersible lands in Oregon has become confused over time, creating clouded land titles. By request of the 2013 legislature, the Department of State Lands formed the Filled Lands Advisory Group, or FLAG, to develop a means of resolving state ownership interest in historically filled submerged and submersible lands. That group has met several times to come up with recommendations on how to proceed, and Senate Bill 912 is the result of some of that work group, which members of the committee were also on.
Yeah, I think Senator Cruz and I would say it was more than a few times.
I believe I read that somewhere.
All right, so let's do this. I have four people that are actually signed up at this point, so I'm going to go ahead and call them all up. Mary Abrams, Martha Pagey, Dave Honeycutt. Dave, could you grab another chair, and Marianne Nash? So if the four of you will come forward while they're coming up, let me ask if there's anyone else in the room who wants to be testifying today on Senate Bill 912. Okay. Rich, we'll get you in.
We'll get it straight.
And just as a precursor, this was a work group that was set up based on legislation that passed last session, if I remember correctly.
Did not pass.
And myself and Senator Cruz.
Chair, it was a work group that was set up in lieu of passing legislation
okay.
last session.
Either way, we were meeting on a monthly basis.
Yes.
Welcome. Who'd like to start off, Mary? Or you?
I sure can. Good morning, Chair Prezanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Abrams, and I'm the Director of the Department of State Lands. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 912. Just as a bit of background, the state of Oregon received ownership of all navigable and tidally influenced waterways at statehood as under the Equal Footing Doctrine, and the responsibility to assure the public trust values for those lands was passed to the State Land Board. As the administrative arm of the State Land Board, the Department of State Lands administers that responsibility. In addition to the ownership of the submerged and submersible lands, as those navigable waterways sometimes were filled, the state had a claim to ownership of the historically filled lands that occurred after the filling. And this is really, as was mentioned by the administrator, this is really a contentious issue oftentimes because it's very difficult to trace the titles and the deeds and who filled what and why they filled it. And so this has resulted in a really complicated set of contentious legal issues, and the department, after having a conversation with this committee in 2013, was very happy to take on the issue and worked with a really great group of people to try and address the issues that were raised. So we formed the FLAG with the idea of trying to address the issue of stakeholders being able to have a fair and transparent and reasonable process to resolve the filled lands issues, and the fact that we would be able to resolve the state ownership issues in a timely manner. I was really pleased in leading this group. Not only did I have both the chair and Senator Cruz, who came to every single meeting. I think maybe we had one meeting where we didn't have both of you there. But we also had a broad array of people who were interested in this issue, including two representatives for the education beneficiaries of the Common School Fund. We had Maddie Sheehan, who represented the recreation issues, Dave Honeycutt here at the table with us, with representing Oregonians in Action. It was he who had actually brought this issue in front of the committee last year. Chris Hathaway from the Lower Columbia Estuary Partnership representing the fisheries issues. Jay McCauley from Marine Environmental and Development, who, despite many physical challenges, came to almost every single meeting or at least participated by phone and was an incredible source of historical information. Paula Miranda from the Port of St. Helens and Martha Pagel, who has represented many landowners in these issues. We had a number of recommendations that came out of the flag. We did meet, I think we did meet monthly and for almost a full day each time. And so it was quite an onerous commitment, and we really appreciated the representation and the interest of the entire group. We made recommendations that would provide a transparent and fair process to purchase or clear title to historically filled lands. We also accepted language as a consensus recommendation to ensure public trust, cultural resource, and other stakeholder interests were accounted for prior to any sale or transfer of historically filled lands. And most importantly, we really worked to try and reduce costs by offering simplified options to clear title if sale or transfer would not unreasonably interfere with public trust values. Reducing these costs is beneficial not just to the department and the Common School Fund, but really to the applicants as well in these issues. It reduces time and also cost in trying to resolve these issues. We have submitted to the committee the full flag report, including the recommendations, and so that's available for anyone who'd like to look in detail at the recommendations that the group came up with. But just as a summary, I would say that the work that is reflected in Senate Bill 912 reflects the flag recommendations that would clarify the distinction between historically filled and new lands. It reaffirms the State Land Board's authority to sell, lease, or trade the newly defined historically filled lands. And it, most importantly, it establishes a process for the State Land Board to identify and declare the state's interest in historically filled lands and provide a notice of that declaration. I do want to note that there was a subgroup that worked after the full flag had finished the majority of their work, and they were trying to work out a process for a statewide identification and notification process, and they agreed to that, to a system to do that. They also noted that the work, because it's fairly significant for the department, really depended on funding so that the department could get the work accomplished. And they also settled on a time that they believed was sufficient, which was 10 years, for the department to complete the identification and official notice, noting, of course, that that wouldn't be the time frame that we'd necessarily clear all of the titles, but at least landowners would be notified. Many of the flag recommendations are administrative in nature, and the department plans to submit these to the State Land Board to initiate rulemaking in June. And they have asked, and I think most of the members of the flag are willing to serve on the Rules Advisory Committee for that effort. We feel like we have worked very successfully with this group. We have a set of consensus recommendations that reflect a broad array of interests, and we are very pleased to support the substantive statutory changes proposed in Senate Bill 912. We do have to note, as a member of the governor's offices, that the budget, the funding that is in Senate Bill 912 is outside of the governor's recommended budget, and therefore the department has to remain neutral on that appropriation request. Thank you very much for hearing this testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
All right, thank you. We'll take questions after we go through the panel. Martha, who's next?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Martha Pagel. I'm an attorney with the firm of Schwabe, Williamson, and Wyatt, and I was a member of the flag work group process. And I did provide a very brief written statement, mainly just to confirm and express my support for the recommendations of the flag group that are reflected in Senate Bill 912 and for the rulemaking process that's to follow. I noted in my testimony that I have been involved in this issue for more than 30 years, and really from both sides of perspective. I started out representing the Department of State Lands, then the Division of State Lands. I eventually became the director and was involved in settlements of these types of clearing title to historically filled lands. And for the last 15 years in private practice, I've represented a number of individual or even the city of Coos Bay in resolving claims of disputed ownership. And one of the major problems that we faced all along the way has been the lack of a clear inventory to know the universe of where these field lands may exist and put property owners on notice. So Senate Bill 912 takes us a very far distance in trying to resolve that problem. And I definitely support the bill and the work of the flag group. And just briefly to conclude, I want to thank the senators, Senator Przanski and Senator Cruz. Also, Senator Johnson and Roblin participated in the process to some extent. I want to compliment and thank the Department of State Lands, Mary Abrams and her staff, Mark Schumach and the AG's office, for putting together a process that has taken us so much farther. I've been involved in at least three different work groups over the years, and we have never been able to make the kind of progress that we made in this effort. I think it was due largely to the department's leadership and commitment to the process, and I thank them for that.
Dave?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. I was a flag member as well, and this bill, as has already been mentioned, is the result of a bill that Senator Cruz introduced for us last session that the chair was kind enough to hear, and the bill wasn't ready for prime time, but obviously that's the reason why the department stepped up and said that they were willing to create to a group to solve this, and the primary issue for us was simply finding a means to an end with this issue. Historically filled lands are lands that were filled usually over a century ago, and this body has been trying to resolve these issues for 50, 60, 70 years to no avail. And so, as Martha indicated, the fact that we got so far with the flag group as we did, and the fact that this bill creates a nice procedural process, and especially when you combine it with the rules that are being proposed, creates a nice process, it simplifies the process, and gets us to the point where we can have an inventory where we know where these lands are, and a process for resolving title claims to those properties is extremely helpful, and is work that that the legislature has been trying to accomplish for years, and I'm glad it's finally at an end. These are because there are disputed title claims on these properties. These properties are like hot potatoes; they get passed from person to person and property owner to property owner, and people don't know what they're getting. And they usually don't know that there's a problem until either they try and sell, they try and loan, get a loan on the property, or they get a notice from the state that the state believes it has an interest. There's a need and a reason why it makes sense to try and get these things resolved. And since we have a fixed universe, then we won't have any more historically filled lands. Whatever that is out there is out there. Notifying these people, putting them on notice, and creating a simplified process, which the rules will do to resolve this, is really good work. I don't usually like work groups; they're kind of a waste of time most often. But this is one that really yielded some good results, and it's in no large part thanks to the chair and the vice chair. It was good work, and I'm really happy to support it.
Thanks, Marianne.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash, and I'm here today with the Oregon Farm Bureau. Oregon Farm Bureau was not part of the flag work group, and so just here today with a couple of comments on the bill. Initially, we wanted to say as a policy matter, we think that the state shouldn't be asserting title to these lands that they have never had anything to do with, and as Mr. Honeycutt mentioned, were often filled more than 100 years ago. However, since we understand that the state is planning to move forward with claims of title to these lands, just have a couple quick comments on the bill. We would really prefer that the notice and identification of these claims happen within a period of 2 years rather than 10 years, so that property owners that have potential claims against title to the property will have that notification and resolution more quickly. And then also understand that the report that came out of the committee's work provides a process for lands that are valued at under $20,000 to just basically have an exchange of quitclaim deeds so that title will revert back to the upland owner. And we would really prefer that that process and at least a floor for those claims be put into the bill and be incorporated into the bill so that landowners with these smaller pieces of property will have certainty that that's going to be the approach for their lands. And then also just wanted to mention that prior to coming up here today, spoke with DSL and clarified that for our farmers, their prior converted cropland, because those are not filled lands, their drain lands would not be under this bill, and that was one of the concerns we had heard raised from our members, so just wanted to get that on the record. So thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Senator Cruz.
Not so much question, more comment. I want to thank Mary for convening the group, and it was a good group. I think we came a long way, but I also think it's appropriate that we don't get too specific in statute on things like this. And I have a level of confidence, Mr. Chair, that the group that's going to preside over the rulemaking will make sure that we keep heading in the right direction. So I think this is a good product.
Great. Thank you. Any other comments or questions? Martha.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to flag one point that as we were preparing for today's presentation, we discovered a glitch in the drafting. So we do want to come back with some somewhat technical amendments, but basically it's to clarify that this process where the land board will issue a declaration to give notice to the property owners, that is not intended to be a final order towards those property owners, because the concept here is that once the landowners get the notice, they'll have the option to either participate in this sort of fast track that would be adopted into the rules, or to, if they want to challenge the claim, they can litigate. And we don't want to foreclose that opportunity to litigate through the courts. So we will be happy to come back to you with some amendments to clarify that point.
Thank you for the clarification and putting that on the record. Of course, worked with Laura. She'll be overseeing the amendments for us. I also would like to take the opportunity that Senator Cruz has and thank you all for all the time that you put in, and Mary for your staff. Really was instrumental. I know I kind of came at a pinch hit when we had Senator Dingfelder go to the city of Portland, and so I learned a lot, and it was very informative.
You were a good replacement. I think you fit in well with the group.
So. Oh, thank you very much. All right, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
The last person I have scheduled to testify is Rich Engstrom. Rich, why don't you come up? Is there anyone else again who wants to testify on Senate Bill 912 today?
Good morning. My name is Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. As many of you probably can guess, we have a fairly significant interest in this issue. I did spend considerable time during the interim. I was not part of the flag, but I did spend a significant time during the interim talking with our membership about it, including doing some tours and things. This is one of those issues you don't really want to give a lot of real specific examples on, because you want to see how things turn out as far as the studies and things go. But we think this general approach, at least in the statutory portion, is a good approach. And the heart of this agreement, obviously, is what's going to come out of the rules, the specificity. And I'm going to stay pretty involved in it. Our interest is going to be on the higher end, the more costly sites where we think between the 20 and 100,000 or over the 100,000 range. So from our industry's perspective, we want to keep a pretty close ear on the ground on this. I would say the only other thing I would say is that the importance, I think the biggest importance for resolving this, especially for the coast and up and down the Willamette Valley, is how this issue is actually getting in the way of economic development in those communities. And taking steps to clear up the title so landowners feel more free, and I'm speaking of my folks, to make the investments necessary on their property when they're worried about whether they have clean title or not. People are not going to make that kind of investment until those issues are cleaned up. So I'm here in support of this, and I thank the chair and Senator Cruz for leading this. And this is a big step. I mean, I've been following it for 20 years. Most of the work, obviously, was done prior a little bit before that, but quite a rich history in the state fighting this issue, and I'm glad we're taking some positive steps to resolve it. So thank you very much.
Thanks. Any questions? One disclaimer, Rich. We were kind of more, let's say, not the leaders of the pack, but the followers. We had certified smart people that were on the front line, including the department and all the other individuals that were here that were part of the flag. So, but thank you for the compliment.
Thank you.
All right. With that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 912. I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 821.
As Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 821 is sponsored by Senator Farioli. We don't have the paperwork back on this bill quite yet, and we don't have any amendments before us today. So currently, the Oregon Tort Claims Act bars actions arising from any act or omission of a public body or an officer, employee, or agent of a public body unless a proper notice of the claim is given, but there are some exceptions to that. Senate Bill 821 adds a notice requirement exception for claims based on conduct constituting child abuse or knowingly allowing, permitting, or encouraging child abuse, and applies to causes of action arising before, on, or after its effective date. The bill, however, adds another exception to the exemptions to exclude claims of negligence arising out of the provision of health care. Senate Bill 821 also revises causes of action based on conduct constituting child abuse or knowingly allowing, permitting, or encouraging child abuse if certain conditions are met.
Thank you. Representative Parrish, you're here on this bill. Why don't you come on forward? While she's coming up, is there anyone else that's here? No one else has signed up. Art, you're going to be coming up? Okay. Why don't you go ahead and come on up if you're coming up on your we got room for more.
Plenty of room. Good morning. Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, Westland and Tualatin, here testifying in behalf of Senate Bill 821, which also has a bill over on the House side that is pretty much the exact same language. I brought this bill. It was House Bill 3478 in 2013, and we heard testimony there in the Judiciary Committee. That bill got watered down and moved to Ways and Means and permanently died. If you are in our state a Boy Scout leader, if you're a priest or a minister and you have sexually abused a child or committed child abuse against a child, we give you a very long time as a victim to come back and seek redress in by a court case. And we've seen some of those cases play out here in Oregon where people who are adults who finally came forward successfully were able to sue the Catholic Church or the Boy Scouts of America. That same level of action is not available if the offender is a public employee. In fact, as I understand it, the statute of limitations on that is about 2 years versus what we've done in the private sector side. So this bill seeks to remedy that. It was very disturbing to actually hear testimony or see a letter from the DOJ on the bill in 2013 talking just about the number of people who would actually come forward if this was enacted. And so, yes, there's going to be a fiscal if we were to do this, but I'm of the thought that if somebody has been particularly had the public trust taken away from them and they've been as a victim of child abuse or sex abuse. And we see these cases. We see them in our news where you've got teachers who are, who have sexually molested or, you know, raped young children. We see this play out with coaches. We see it in all number of public employees. But to actually see in print a letter from the Department of Justice talking about, at least 20 cases a year would come forward, I think that that's a problem. And I think that we clearly have issues if we are not taking care of young children in the state of Oregon. And then to have such a very short window that a child could come forward and litigate and seek justice from the state of Oregon is a problem. So I am in favor of Senate Bill 821 and the House bill that's over on the other side as well. I think this is an important piece of legislation. I think it provides parity for the kids who are being victimized by public employees. I think that we can't accept that 2 years is enough for a victim under the age of 18 to be in a clear state of mind to come forward and actually address their perpetrator. And so I do support this bill. I know Senator Farioli has brought this, and I believe he's going to be here later to come testify, so I don't want to steal his thunder, but I do support the bill and would like to see us take some action on this year. I think for those children, it's only fair that we create parity in the system.
Thank you. Representative, do you need to be excused to go back?
Wait till this panel's done and just...
I have one question. I just want, but if you need to take off, I just was going to throw it out.
I do have committee, but it's they'll wait. This is important, Bill.
All right. So then why don't we go ahead and let whoever's going to testify.
I'm Catherine Clark, and I'm here to speak in favor of this bill as well, with one exception. There are actually, I believe, two bills pending, House bills pending, that do exactly the same thing. Neither one of those bills have an exemption that this bill has for health care providers. And I'm going to suggest to you that if it is important, as I believe it is, to make public employees subject to the same rules as private people about child abuse, that there is no cause to exempt health care providers from that protection, or the patients of health care providers from that protection. So this bill has a clause in it that should not be there. And if it's removed, then you have the same thing as the two House bills that I think are already, I think there's two.
Well, one's mine. I don't know if there's a second one.
Yeah, I think there's two that are doing exactly the same thing. It's the same bill, and we are in favor of that bill.
Okay. Questions?
For the record, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers, and just wanted to put us organizationally on record in support.
All right. Questions? Senator Thatcher first.
I didn't catch what organization or who you're representing.
I'm with the Oregon Trial Lawyers as well.
Thank you. Okay, I just didn't catch that at first. Thanks.
All right. So I do have one question. In reading or hearing the summary, it says that we affect a before, during, and after. So that means it's a retro. How far back does it go?
Chair Przanski, I don't know if Senator Ferrioli's is different, but mine does open it up. It's similar to the bill that I have on
far
the House
back.
Side. It opens it up the same way we would have for Boy Scouts, or it's that same time limit.
Okay.
Is what we're looking for. Makes it comparable to what we've done in the private sector.
All right. Any other comments? Thank you all very much.
Thanks.
For coming forward. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 821. And I'm going to go ahead and call up for Senate Bill 236.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 236 comes to us at the request of the governor's office on behalf of Oregon State Police. So we do not have the paperwork back on this bill, and we don't have any amendments before us today. Currently, under Oregon law, the director of the Oregon Department of Administrative Services possesses the authority to carry out the provisions of the Public Contracting Code. DAS serves as the enterprise-wide purchasing authority for the state of Oregon. Senate Bill 236 additionally authorizes the Department of State Police to enter into lease agreements and take title to real property. As the superintendent of state police considers necessary for the performance of the duties of the Department of State Police and the Oregon State Police.
All right, thank you. I have Patrick Ashmore.
Ah,
already here. Patrick, was anyone else going to come up with you? Or
no,
you're
sir.
On your own? Solo again.
Yes, sir.
All right, thank you. Go ahead.
Senator Przanski, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Patrick Ashmore. I am the Deputy Superintendent of the Oregon State Police. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 236, obviously, since we submitted the concept. Here's what the bill does. It amends the current statute and allows OSP to take hold title to real property and directly enter into lease agreements. Our services require facilities which have very specific needs and vary from location and services. Our offices and our facilities are not standard business office configurations. So the bill has two parts: directly enter into lease agreements with our lab facilities and our medical examiner facilities. We oversee lease development, design, construction, modifications due to accreditation requirements. Under the current structure, DAS is also involved in this process. As DAS staff is not trained for the special requirements of the accreditation, the bulk of the work falls on our staff who oversee these specialized areas. Ultimately, however, DAS must approve the activity. The duplication of effort is both inefficient and costly for OSP. The ability to direct enter into leases would help us also with opportunities to co-locate with other local government agencies and help us for facility sharing. The second part is own real property. In the case of our laboratories, sometimes the landlords think they deserve a premium rent because our facilities need scientific equipment. Oftentimes there's modifications to the buildings which In all cases, we're responsible for that, and we pay for that. But by not being able to own our own property, in particularly, again, the forensics and the medical examiner offices, we're losing out on opportunities to purchase the property. And with that approach, it's very costly for our agency. It also gives us an inability to hold out on potential of buying our property that places us in an inferior negotiating position. These factors result in expending funds for facilities, which is at a greater rate than is necessary. Industry studies and review by DASH show that a long-term owning property is a lower cost and alternative than renting and leasing. Additionally, once initial costs have acquired, the property have been paid off, the property becomes a state asset, which is a value to the agency and to the state. I have some examples that I gave you. I think you have in the testimony, the written testimony, but an example of where the state would save money by owning, a biennial cost to lease Trailstead, which is the facility we're going to be moving into in July of 16, if we were to lease that property, the cost is approximately $6.6 million per biennium. If we were to buy that piece of property and build, it would be $5.7 million. So the potential biennial savings, if owned, is approximately $919,000 per biennium. An example of sites where it would cost less to lease would be Oak Ridge, which is a small town on Highway 58 just east of Eugene. Cost to lease that right now is $36,000 a biennium. If we would have to go break ground and build a facility to meet our needs, it would cost us biennially $172,000. So potential biennial savings, if leased, is approximately $136,000. Examples of DAS charges to OSP, and I don't want to look like we're rolling DAS under the bus, but Portland office is an example. For us to just renew our existing lease is going to be $21,000. The Warrington office, which is over in Astoria on the coast, it's $10,800 to draft a new lease. And again, Trailstead is $152,000 to draft a new lease. So I thank you for this opportunity and would ask if you have any questions. I'd be happy to try to answer those.
All right, thank you. Any questions, Senator Thatcher?
Yeah. Excuse me. I'm not sure if we're having more testimony or if maybe you could answer the question, but I'm just wondering what the historical reasons were for not precluding the state police from purchasing their own property.
Well, I guess what I'm going to say, I'll let Patrick take the first shot. I think I understand, but go ahead.
Senator Thatcher, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, I know it's been over 50 years since we've been able to own her. I'll be honest with you, I don't think we ever have. I think they 50 years ago, I understand there were three or four or five state agencies that were kind of cut out that could own their own property, and we were not one of them.
Yeah. My understanding, I think DAS was just kind of like the center point to control all of this, and so you wouldn't have agencies going out and doing their own purchasing and stuff and trying to economize scale. But then we also understand from the testimony today there may be some exceptions to that rule. Any other comments or questions? Thank you very much. Let me see if there's anyone else who wants to give testimony on a House bill, Senate Bill 236. Not seeing anyone. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 236. And I think we're going to start in on our larger of the bills. So let's go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 849.
Yes, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 849 is sponsored by Senator Knope and Representative Bueller, among others. We don't have the paperwork back for us today on this bill. I do understand there's some amendments being currently worked on. So the state of Oregon includes 13 ski areas, and Oregon's ski statutes date back to 1979. Recently, there have been revived discussions regarding the liability of ski areas and to what degree it may be limited. This occurred, for instance, in the recent case of Bagley v. Mount Bachelor Incorporated, decided by the Oregon Supreme Court in December of 2014. Senate Bill 849 revises Oregon ski statutes to allow ski area operators to limit liability, except in cases of intentional acts or gross negligence. The bill defines terms related to skiing. It also clarifies skier responsibilities. Senate Bill 849 also applies to activities occurring on or after the effective date. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
All right, thank you. Before I call people up, I've got a list of registering for testimony. Then I also have kind of, let's call it a cheat sheet for panels. There is one panel, it looks like John Gifford, Andy Bayette, and Brad Stanford are here to answer questions only, or are you giving testimony as well? That just tells me how to call people up. Okay, so let's go ahead and start with our first panel. It's going to be John Tullis, Dave Rathbun, and Matthew Drake. Morning, gentlemen. If you'll give us your name before your testimony, it would be great.
Good morning, Chair Prusansky and committee members. My name is John Tullis. I live in Welches, Oregon, and I'm the Director of Public Affairs at Timberline Lodge, speaking on behalf of Senate Bill 849, and specifically about how the sport of skiing has changed since the original skier activities law was written in 1979. So as someone who's been in the ski industry at Timberline Lodge for 31 years now, and having served as the president of the Oregon Ski Industries Association in the 1990s, I've watched the sport evolve in many ways over the years. And to sort of set the table here, if you will, the perspective I wanted to share with you this morning is that from a very practical standpoint, it's now both timely and judicious to update and revise the skier activities law, to modernize it, if you will. As I said, the original skier activity statute was signed into law in 1979. Back then, Mount Bachelor was basically a big backyard ski area to Bend, with a population of about 17,000. I don't want to make us all feel old, but skier fashion isn't the only thing that's changed since then. Our ski area equipment and skier equipment has changed. The technological nature of our uphill conveyances, our chairlifts, have changed. Our approach to grooming the ski areas has changed. And in 1979, snowboarding did not even exist. It was just coming onto the scene when I started working at Timberline in the winter of 1984. While the term freestyle existed in our sport back then, freestyle terrain parks did not. So neither did the terrain features now known as half pipes, quarter pipes, hits, ramps, jibs, and fun boxes. So as you can see, certain definitions and terminology also simply did not exist when the original statute was written. The development of terrain parks is probably it's something that ski areas, area operators now spend over 50% of their time and resources on. That's probably the most significant development that I've seen over my years. When I started in 1984, skier visits in the state were relatively stagnant. It was flat. And it was this growing popularity of snowboarding and the advent of terrain features that really pumped the energy and enthusiasm into our sport and revived the Oregon ski product and provided jobs and economic boost at winter recreation. Now contributes to our state's economy. The other thing, I guess, that's changed is the whole Oregon ski experience and how it relates to tourism and economic development. It's now really a world-class destination. After all, where else in the Northern Hemisphere can you go to the airport in August and see people with skis? At Timberline, we boast the longest ski season in North America and the finest summer ski program anywhere in the world. So my colleagues will provide more detail on the specifics to 849, but I wanted to conclude by simply suggesting that I think it's an important opportunity to revise our skier activities law in order to update it, to clarify the responsibilities of both the skier and the ski area, and also to further engage and educate today's skiers with the skier's responsibility code. So thank you very much for giving this consideration.
Thank you. Who's going to go next?
I am. Thank you very much, Chairman Prusansky, members of the committee. My name is Dave Rathbun. I'm the president and general manager of Mount Bachelor and the chairman of the Pacific Northwest Ski Areas Association. I've worked in the ski industry for 30 years, 15 years in Vermont, 8 years in Colorado, and now the last 7 years in Oregon. I'm here to support Senate Bill 849 based on its economic impact on resort operating costs and the potential, if it's not passed, to result in higher costs for lift tickets and season passes for Oregonians and our out-of-state guests. Skiing is a recreational pursuit enjoyed by hundreds of thousands of Oregonians and people from all over the world. They come here to our slopes, and they have, as John just said, an incredible experience. I've had the ability to work at some pretty big destination resorts, and the experience we offer here in Oregon is equal to, if not better than, many of those resort experiences. By not passing SB 849, Oregon ski areas will be faced with increased legal fees and higher insurance premiums. States hosting ski areas in the Pacific West have protections from liability lawsuits, either in the form of state statutes addressing the inherent risks of the sports or through the acceptance of pre-activity release contracts. Several states in our region incorporate both of these protections. Unfortunately, accidents do happen in skiing, but the majority of these accidents are a result of the inherent risks of the sport. The Oregon Skiing Activities Statutes, or ORS 30.970 through 30.990, are outdated as they were written in 1979. Likewise, the recent Bagley v. Mount Bachelor ruling has rendered the use of releases unenforceable. Today, Oregon ski areas have neither an updated statute or enforceable releases to protect them from lawsuits filed based on incidents occurring from the inherent risks of the sport. It costs the same amount of money to defend a suit, whether you're a large corporate-owned ski area or a ski area owned by a sole proprietor. Hiring expert witnesses alone can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars per trial. Similarly, insurance premiums will skyrocket without passage of SB 849. Premiums are based on loss ratios. The more money paid out in claims, the higher the ratio is to premium collected. That's when insurance rates soar. These costs will be passed on to skiers, just as increases in costs like fuel, wages, and health care are passed along. It may be easier for the larger resorts to pass these costs on to a larger base of customers, but for Oregon's smaller resorts, these added fees could price them out of their markets. Please consider these key points as you decide whether SB 849 goes to the Senate floor. Thousands of Oregonians look forward to skiing our mountains every year and hope to be able to do so affordably for as long as they possibly can into the future. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Matthew?
Good morning, Chairman Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Matthew Drake. I'm the chairman and CEO of Mounted Meadows, which includes Mounted Meadows Ski Resort and Cooper Spur Mountain Resort on Mount Hood. I'm a fourth-generation Oregonian. My dad, Franklin, founded our company in 1968, and I've been involved with the company and skiing in Oregon since that time. I became CEO in 2006. I'm a board member of the Pacific Northwest Ski Area Association and the National Ski Area Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in strong support of Senate Bill 849. My testimony to you this morning is going to focus on the significant importance of the ski industry to the state of Oregon, with particular focus on the rural communities in which the resorts have been located for several decades, including Cooper Spur Mountain Resort, which has the distinction of being one of the oldest special use permit areas in the United States, with a permit inception date of 1921. The Oregon ski industry provides nearly 7,000 jobs, representing a payroll of almost $200 million annually, according to the 2012 economic impact study performed by the University of Oregon. These are mostly, almost entirely, rural jobs, representing a significant amount of payroll in the local communities. Ski areas are often the largest private employer in these rural communities. Using Mounted Meadows and Cooper Spur Resort as examples, we employ nearly 1,100 people during the course of the season, and we are Hood River County's largest employer. Oregon ski areas provide job opportunities and seasonal income for individuals and families. Skiers and snowboarders spend about $260 million annually in an average Oregon ski season. This season may be an anomaly. More than half of this amount is spent on the way to or from the resorts. The traveling skier is the winter lifeblood for rural businesses. That includes local restaurants, gas stations, groceries and convenience stores, sports and retail shops. Last year, Mount Hood area lodging properties alone collected over $1 million in lodging tax, about one-third of that by Clackamas County. Occupancy during the winter months are three to four times greater than they are in the shoulder season months, and that's for lodging properties as well as the traffic in and out of the rest of the businesses. Without a ski season, these lodgers would face 8 months of shoulder season occupancy, which is not economically sustainable. The revenues generated by Oregon ski areas come at a time when Oregon's rural communities need it the most. Oregon summer tourism infrastructure is underutilized during the winter months, and ski areas provide employment that complements and sustains seasonal jobs, allowing rural businesses to maintain their year-round financial viability. Why is this update to the skiing activities statute so critically important to Oregon and the rural communities? It's pretty straightforward. Ski areas and ski resorts are seasonal businesses highly dependent on snowfall and cold weather. Uncertainty is as much a part of our business as it is for farmers, and it's been that way since 1968. We have no Farm Subsidy Act nor weather-related insurance. The proposed changes to the statute help clarify the responsibilities of skiers as well as the ski area operators through the signing of a release. The current statute opens the door for costly claims resulting in increased operator costs, reduced opportunities for employment, economic development activity, and reduced public participation in developed recreation in Oregon. The cost of recreating in Oregon will become more expensive than the states around us, resulting in exporting our user visits to more affordable areas. In short, there will be less revenue for supporting businesses and fewer people employed by the ski areas, adversely affecting our rural communities. There will be lower snow park fees that will be collected by the snow park system to support the plowing and then the access to the recreation areas for Oregonians who visit these areas in the winter. There will be reduced Forest Service fees collected, a portion of which are used for fire mitigation and suppression within our national forest lands in Oregon. Increased costs and uncertainty will drive some ski areas out of business, again, adversely affecting the rural communities and the people who live there. In summary, the University of Oregon 2012 economic study concluded ski resorts generate nearly $500 million of economic activity for the state of Oregon, the majority of which directly benefits our rural areas and the people who live there. I urge your support in passing Senate Bill 849, as the impact of not updating the skier statute will eventually cost jobs, limit access to public lands, and threaten the economic stability of these areas and the state of Oregon as a whole. Thank you for the opportunity to testify and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward. Our next panel is going to be John Gifford, Andy Bayat, I believe, Brad Stanford, and Jim Austin. I think we have four chairs up there for the table.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is John Gifford. I'm president of the Pacific Northwest Ski Areas Association. PNSAA is a nonprofit trade association representing the interests of 35 winter recreation resorts in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Alaska, Montana, and Northern California. In Oregon, there are 13 members of the association. The industry in Oregon is nearly $500 million and employing over 6,700 people, attracting over 2 million visitors annually. On behalf of the member resorts in Oregon, I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 849. This legislation is an update of Skiing Activity Statutes ORS 30.970 to 30.990. including the addition that permits the use of release agreements. There are a number of states that have been updating or are considering updating their ski area statutes. And within our association, there are two states that have done that in the last couple years. Idaho legislature passed updates to their ski statutes in February 2014. Including in those updates, the broad protections of resorts when guests are injured in terrain parks or inbounds avalanches. Expanding the statute's definition of skier to include snowboarding, Nordic skiing, cross-country skiing, snowshoes, and freestyle terrain. It added the provision that states that skiers expressly assume the risk and legal responsibility for injuries resulting from any movement of snow, including but not limited to slides, sloughs, avalanches, and provides skiers protections from injuries resulting from tree well immersions, snowmaking mounds, and injuries in terrain parks. In Montana, they passed legislation just this last February, 2015, and included in that was a revised definition of inherent risks of skiing, and which includes any depth of snow accumulation around or near trees or snowmaking equipment. Also includes that avalanches are an inherent risk of skiing, and includes as skiing as in the definition of skiing as events and competitions and the practice and training for those events and competitions. On behalf of the 13 Oregon resorts, I urge you to support passage of Senate Bill 849. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right, thank you. We'll take the rest of the panel, and then we'll take questions. Who's next?
I'll go next. Good morning, Chair Brzezinski and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to present today on this very important issue. My name is Andy Balliott. I'm an attorney from Bend, Oregon. I regularly represent ski areas, including Mount Bachelor, and have done so for over 20 years. I'm the attorney on the Bagley versus Mount Bachelor case. I'm here to speak in support of SB 849 because I firmly believe that it is so important for the viability of ski areas. Dave Rathbun made some points about skiing is inherently dangerous. Accidents do happen in the absence of negligence. He also made the point that other states have protections. What I want to focus on this morning and advise you on it is the unique position that Oregon is now in after the Bagley decision. As Mr. Rathbun mentioned, it has been recognized across the country that there are inherent risks that simply cannot be entirely eliminated. A ski area is not in control of a skier or snowboarder. So, for example, if someone encounters a snow feature, 10 people can hit the same snow feature and have 10 different results depending on speed, course, angle, and what trick they're trying to perform. People choose what slope they want to go down, black diamond, medium, or beginner. Because of that, the states all across the country have protected ski areas in one of two ways. One is by enforcing release agreements. The other is by statute. So let's just look at the Pacific Northwest. And in Washington, in the state of Washington, ski areas are able to enter into release agreements for ordinary negligence only, not gross negligence. So the state of Washington ski areas are protected and have a mechanism to avoid costly and lengthy litigation. The same is true with our neighbor to the south in California. Release agreements are routinely enforced in California, again, subject to, has to be ordinary negligence, has to be clear and unambiguous agreements knowingly and intelligently entered into. And that is true across the country where states don't have statutes limiting actions. Almost every state enforces release agreements. After 30 years of enforcing release agreements, we no longer have that post-Bagley. Statutory examples in the Pacific Northwest would include Alaska, where in Alaska, the statute simply states that because of the inherent risk of skiing, skiers are barred from bringing a claim based upon an inherent risk. The identical situation is true in Idaho. Idaho doesn't have release agreements because Idaho has a statute that says you cannot bring an action arising out of an inherent risk of skiing. The reason that's so important, again, is because otherwise you're forced to litigate each and every one of these cases, and it makes it financially impossible. The difficulty with the current statute post-Bagley ORS 30.975 is that it does indicate that skiers and snowboarders assume the inherent risks of skiing, but then it says, insofar as they are reasonably obvious, expected, or necessary. That creates an issue of fact in each and every case. All the plaintiff attorney has to do is file an affidavit saying they have an expert who will testify that it was that the inherent risk was not reasonably obvious, expected, or necessary. So in summary, I would ask this committee to consider the fact that Oregon ski areas are simply asking to be put back into the mainstream and have some mechanism to dispense of these claims without having to litigate all the way through a jury trial, which is our current situation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Brad Stanford. I'm an attorney from Portland. I come from a family of skiers. I learned to ski at Hoodoo when I was six. My mom took me up on the ski bus. I'm here to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 849. I have represented Oregon ski areas as well since 1990. My job here today is to just give you a little summary of what this bill actually does, putting aside the reinstatement of the release portion. As you heard, this statute is old, and the ski business has changed a lot since 1979. So our bill contains new definitions. They include things like a definition of freestyle terrain, and that includes terrain parks and so on. There is an expanded non-exclusive list now of the inherent risks of the sport, and that includes freestyle terrain, snow immersion, and snow movement. There is a new definition of skiing to specifically include snowboarding and any other means of sliding down a hill on a slippery surface. The statute makes it clear that all inherent risks are assumed by the skier. And it makes it clear that persons cannot sue for injuries due to the inherent risks of the sport. The duties of skiers are updated as well. And that includes making it clear that collisions between skiers and snowboarders, which are an inherent risk of the sport, but making it clear that collisions between skiers and snowboarders are the responsibility of the overtaking skier. This Senate Bill 849 makes it clear that skiers involved in an accident must leave contact information before departing the ski area. That's been a problem. This bill also requires skiers to inspect freestyle terrain before using it. The statute makes it clear that ski areas have no duty to judge a skier's skills or ability to meet the risks of the sport. It also makes it clear that ski areas have no duty to judge, nor can they judge, a person's ability to use an uphill conveyance. And it makes it clear that skiers are presumed to know these duties under the law. There are some amendments that touch on a couple of other areas, including that skiers shall be the sole judges of their ability to use uphill conveyances like chairlifts, and that violation of the skier's duties by skiers shall constitute negligence per se. As Mr. Balyat mentioned, the obvious, expected, or necessary language is taken out. It's unworkable. It means nothing. For example, if there's a heavy snowfall at a ski area that covers a rock or a small tree, it's not visible, it's not expected, because it's covered by fresh snowfall. a skier hits it and inevitably will claim negligence on the part of the ski area. A ski area cannot do anything about that. It's covered. It's not visible. It's not expected. That's an example of where this language fails. And I do want to say, I noticed in the written materials that there is some written material. I don't know if this person's going to testify or not, but there is some written material from a Mr. McNeil. I view the committee to urge that consideration of that written material with caution. Mr. McNeil testifies for plaintiffs against ski areas. The U.S. Terrain Park Council is not a credible or recognized organization within the ski industry.
I guess now I'd be, as a judge, saying you're commenting on another witness, so why don't we just stick to what you want to tell us and not comment on as to the character of other people who may submit testimony to us.
I appreciate that. Thank you,
you bet.
Chairman Przanski.
As a prosecutor, you know, every once in a while I got to throw it out there.
In essence, then, really what this bill accomplishes is an updating and clarification of a very old law, and we ask that the committee support it. Thank you.
Thank you. Jim?
For the record, Jim Austin, Community Relations Manager for Oregon's Mount Hood Territory, which serves as the destination marketing organization for Clackamas County. I'm actually here presenting testimony in favor of Senate Bill 849 on behalf of my director, Danielle Cowan, who unfortunately could not be here today. She had a conflict. So, dear Przanski and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to comment on Senate Bill 849. This important legislation is necessary for ensuring the viability of Oregon's snow recreation industry. Clackamas County and Central, Eastern, and Southern Oregon each depend on snow sports as an economic engine. Danielle Cowan, have the privilege of serving as the Executive Director of Oregon's Mount Hood Territory. As I said, it's a destination marketing organization for Clackamas County. We're responsible for tourism promotion, development, and development within the county. Our operating revenues come from the county's transient lodging tax, which is 6% on lodging. And our work is guided by the Tourism Development Council, and it's basically on behalf of that Tourism Development Council that we're offering these comments in support of 849. As our name suggests, Mount Hood factors prominently into our visitor attractiveness. Skiing and other snow sports are a major driver of tourism activity on the mountain and in the surrounding communities. Timberline boasts the longest ski season in North America, while Ski Bowl offers more night skiing than any other resort in the country. The mountain's proximity to a major metropolitan area. A major metropolitan area and an international airport paired with the recreational activities available contribute immensely to the economic vitality of our region and arguably the entire state. The economic impact of this activity is clearly measurable within our region. RTRT is collected monthly and categorized under two categories, lodging type and zones, and we have those zones categorized as the mountain region, which is basically Sandy on up to Government Camp, the I-205 region, the I-205 zone, the I-5 zone, and then the rest of the county, which we list as rural. While the TRT revenues for the mountain zone are generally strong throughout the year, they lag behind the I-5 and I-205 zones, with the exception of during the winter months, December, January, February, they are solidly number one. And this can be attributed to the ski activity up in that area. So this discernible shift demonstrates that snow-related tourism is critical to the vitality of our rural communities on the mountain and probably throughout the Oregon as a whole. From a DMO's perspective, we feel that the bottom line is that winter sport recreational activities and most other recreational activities, for that matter, come with their own set of inherent risks. It is a common sense understanding that engaging in these activities could result in injury or, in worst case, death. Conditions that arise in the natural environment, trees, rocks, ice, drop-offs, water, cold, etc., can be difficult to negotiate but should be expected and prepared for. Sometimes a participant's underestimation of the conditions are the issue at hand, or their overestimation of their ability to deal with them are the issue. Then there are those times that the issue must be attributed to either Mother Nature, bad luck, or accidents. We feel that the previous approach to dealing with recreational risks has enabled Oregon to grow and prosper through its recreational industries, and this prosperity is arguably extended to other connected recreational industries such as apparel, shoes, equipment, etc. Think Nike, Columbia Sportswear, and other recreational equipment manufacturers. We recognize the need for a balanced approach to recreational liability concerns, and we believe that Senate Bill 849 provides that balance of common sense and balanced and fair liability assumption.
All right. Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Looks like I've lost a couple of my members. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Well, I'm not sure, Jim. I'll let you know. Thank you all very much for coming forward.
Thank you. Thank you.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to take a brief recess here on 849 and open up a public hearing to take Senator Ferriola's testimony on 821, I believe. Senator Ferriola? We've already taken some testimony, just to let you know that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, for the record, Ted Ferriola, Senate District 30. Mr. Chairman, if you've taken testimony and had an explanation of the bill, which I'm sure will be far more expert than the one that I could provide, what you'll note is that this bill essentially is a bill that revives a cause of action that could have expired. The Department of Justice estimates that there could be as many as 20 cases per year of cases that could be revived under this approach, under the approach that Senate Bill 821 would provide. And, you know, I think it's very important for us to note that these cases of abuse would happen to a minor child under 18 while in custody of our youth authority or in the Department of Human Services. So, you know, this basically applies to situations where a child is in close custody or is in supervision. So, Mr. Chairman, I think rather than belabor the issue, I will rely on those that have already testified and just lend my support to this bill. It is an opportunity for us to allow folks to refile their cases if they have missed the notification requirements due to their either their status as minors or late discovery or late disclosure of the abuse.
Okay. Thank you. Just to let you know, Representative Parrish was here. Also, Catherine Clark and Art Towers came up and gave testimony in support.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions?
I hope there are no questions.
Thank you very much.
Chair.
All right, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 821, reopen our recess and take additional public testimony on Senate Bill 849. And what I have here is four individuals that have signed up who want to speak against the bill, and that's Lauren and Miles Bagley. I also have Art Johnson, who I saw left the room, and Catherine Clark. So who is here? Why don't y'all come up, and we can get Art back up here when he gets back. And I'll tell you, why don't we do this? Yeah, why don't we go ahead and pull, and you can pull one of the other chairs away so we can have them. Okay. Yeah, why don't we do that? Miles, why don't you come on around over here?
I think Art's going to be back, so.
Well, we can get Art up by himself.
Oh, okay.
He's been on the block once or twice. Good morning. And whoever would like to start, we just need to have your name for the record, please.
Good morning, Chair Pruszynski and committee members. My name is Lauren Bagley. I am the mother of Miles, who you keep hearing about from the Supreme Court case. Miles got injured in 2006 while in high school, took a jump, a man-made jump, in a train park at Mount Bachelor. He was thrown in a direction he never intended to go, landed on a surface that was not capable of absorbing the impact. You can hear that life can flash before your eyes in a tragic situation. I can say that's not a cliche, it is true. My life flashed before my eyes when I received a phone call that he was being airlifted off the mountain and taken to the emergency room. He could not move his legs. People and machines, we arrived there, people and machines were rushing around. It was like being in a TV show. I found my way to the head of his bed and asked him what happened. He told me exactly what happened from start to finish in that train park. It was surreal. My husband lay sobbing on the floor. I was on my own to handle this. It was hard. I knew, hearing what he had told me, that I needed to prod further into investigating that, but I had to focus on what I had to focus on, which was him. Our lives were shattered. Our loss is huge. We have been physically and emotionally traumatized. Shock, numbness, fear, loss of control, just a total stop in time happened to us. He lay there broken in two, basically life and death. I won't talk about his medical challenges and what he's gone through then. Today, he continues. One, he won't walk. Two, he has pain, constant, headaches, nausea, and a lot of other personal things I will not get into. At the point in time, he was a senior in high school, looking forward to college, playing college soccer, becoming independent. Mm. As a mom, it was very painful to me see my child hurting, but we couldn't fall apart. We wanted to put our hands up and say enough, but we kept going. Tears welled up in my eyes one day. He looked at me and he said, "Mom, if you start, I will never stop." That was it. I stopped. I resent what happened to Miles at Bachelor. I can't fix him physically, but maybe I can help prevent this from happening to some other child. The ski industry markets heavily to children. As we fought through the courts for 8 long years to invalidate a release just so we could talk about negligence, I learned a lot. I learned jumps in terrain parks, jumps made by staff, have no measurements. Length, width, height, angle, no measurements. They are formed by guys not unskilled, but untrained formally. This happened in 2006. They push mounds of snow around and groomers shape it, test it, call it good. That's how they handle it. They take no science, no math, nothing into consideration. According to the ski industry, their labor pool is highly transient. So what does that tell you? It doesn't give you a lot of comfort level about stability. There's a lot of different organizations that have standards. The X Games, a lot of U.S. competitions, worldwide competitions use standards. The Olympics use standards. Why? Because they care about the safety of their athletes. And the same thing should be applied to the general paying public. I've also learned through these long years battling through the courts, a consistent attitude of the ski industry. It's almost like they're in denial. The trade is, we heard all about money. That's what we heard. We never heard about safety, ever. It's always about money. So it leads me to believe they deny it exists. There's a lot of challenges and there's a lot of things that they cannot change. That is true. There's no doubt about that. But man-made features are man-made. Humans make mistakes. They cannot deny the fact that possibly a mistake was made. Not everything is an accident. Some things are preventable. They just shift the blame to the skier. That's what they do, constantly to the skier. They're stepping up to accept responsibility. It seems to be a very tough thing for them to do. The ski industry is a business. No longer it is a ma and pa that needs this immunity. They're owned by large corporations. Not the Mount Bachelor, not even in Oregon. Their corporation headquarters is Utah. So granting them further immunity to me makes absolutely no sense. The talk about the bill and talk about, say, Section 3 in the freestyle mentions freestyle terrain. You got to be careful here with definitions because they'll be this big and they'll take in everything they can with one definition. freestyle terrain. Freestyle skiing is a style of skiing. Freestyle. It is done all over the mountain. It is not necessarily done just in one little piece of real estate. The one little piece of real estate is what they really want protection from is the train park, which are man-made features. So something that worries me. Another thing that really worries me is, well, two things. One particular is the skier must inspect freestyle terrain. My question to that is, inspect what? Do they need tape measures? Do they need angle measures? What are they expecting their patrons to inspect? That is their job. The company who wrote the code, I've spoken to twice. Both times they have told me the same thing. That is the responsibility of the ski area before it opens to the general public. That is not the general public. That is a overbroad and very scary thing that they're trying to include. That's just not doable. The skier's ability, that's hard. I'm with them on that. That's hard to judge. But I stopped being with them when I know a 10-year-old got killed at Mount Bachelor in 2004 in an expert-level terrain park. How did they get in there? How? Okay, so other states monitor. They monitor. They may make people take skill tests. They may make them watch videos. They may make them buy another pass to get in the train park. There's some level of monitoring. So it's not a free-for-all, and they hold no responsibility to anybody. I'm so angered by sitting here and listening to the whole talk about economics. I didn't hear one mention of safety through all the previous panels. That disturbs me. There's a balance. They keep saying the word balance, but there really isn't a balance. Everything is shifted to the patron, and that is not fair. I've been shocked for a lot of things that happened through this journey. But one of the biggest surprises I had was at the Supreme Court level. And when asked, what was your incentive for safety? The answer was caring people. Well, caring people is not enough for me. And obviously it wasn't enough for the Supreme Court. That when you keep saying how risky it is and just say we have caring people, there's a gap there that needs to be filled. And this bill will further immunize them. It won't bring them to the table to realize the things. I have a son who has new challenges every day. He tries. And trying is important. It's an important thing in life, and it's been extremely important for him to keep trying and overcome all these new challenges he has. I don't think he'll ever stop trying. He's determined. He's a very determined young man. In the ICU before his first 7-hour surgery, it was chaotic. They were getting ready to take him down to his surgery. He asked all the hospital staff to leave the room so he could have a few moments with his family. He was in high school. I have to keep saying that because this is a long time ago. This has been a long journey. He asked everybody to leave the room, which I wasn't sure what was going on. He wanted to have a few minutes to speak with his family. We went around in a circle and spoke. It was the hardest moment in my life as a mother because he literally thought that surgery was going to fix him. He was going to walk again. It was hard. He was hurt on a man-made jump. I have to keep saying that. Humans make errors. They can't be immunized entirely for things they make. As the ski industry changes mountains, they build tubing runs. They build terrain parks. They may have zip lines. They may have mountain bike. They change the mountain. Things no longer become inherent. The example of snow on a rock this morning. If snow covers a rock, that's inherent. There's things that are inherent to this and their sport, but there's things that are not. They're asking for immunity that no other sport is asking for. Every sport's evolved. Every sport has evolved. The only other sport in Oregon or activity that has a statute is equine, and equine is not asking for near the protection. I just want to know you to know that for an industry that does not have standards, does not use best practices, will not divulge what they use for best practices, does not warrant state protection from immunity. They do it's too dangerous to give them that. I believe they'll cut corners, because the bottom line, as you heard today from everyone on their panel, is about revenue and economics. There are risks from faulty jump design and construction, and these risks arise because humans built them. Humans make mistakes. How can the ski industry deny that fact? They're not human. Humans make mistakes.
Ms. Bagley, I'm going
please,
to need
I'm,
just
I'm
to
just
wrap
summarizing.
Up.
Please do not support this immunity bill. Help us do something before my son's tragedy becomes some other child's tragedy. I urge you to vote no on Senate Bill 849, and I thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you. I know this is very difficult for you to be here. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Miles, I'm going to let you go next if you have comments that you'd like to make.
I was actually just up here to for support.
Okay. Well, let's do this. First, let's see if there's any questions for Ms. Bagley. There's not. So I'm going to go ahead and let y'all two step back and let Art Johnson come forward and let him and Catherine Clark.
Yeah, I have some comments.
Yeah, you're staying.
Okay. Okay.
And while Art's getting to up here, is there anyone else who wants to testify today on 849? All right, I'll let y'all choose who's going to go first.
All right. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Clark, and I was privileged to represent Miles Bagley in the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court. In 1979, the legislature worked out a careful balance and compromise between the responsibility of ski areas on the one hand and the responsibility of skiers on the other. And they did this by defining the inherent risks, those risks which are integral to the sport and which are reasonably obvious, expected, or necessary, and putting those on the skier who assumes those risks. And therefore, the ski area has an immunity from any liability for damages that are caused by those inherent risks. It was a recognition that those inherent risks are simply that, inherent to the sport. The industry's response, ultimately, was to go beyond this compromise that the legislature gave them and to require releases of liability by everybody who used the facility, either in a season pass agreement, as it was in the Miles Bagley case, or on the back of a lift ticket. These agreements exist. In one case that's just coming out of the Court of Appeals right now, it was 212 words on the back of a lift ticket. School crammed into a space 2.5 inches square. And this, they say, is a contract by which they release the liability for negligence, for unreasonable conduct of the ski areas. But the people who use those tickets and sign those agreements don't realize what it is that they're doing. They think, as Miles Bagley did, who signed the season pass agreement, that was an actual signed agreement. He thought he was releasing them from any responsibility for the inherent risks of his sport. And that's what most people think. They don't think that what they're releasing is unreasonable and avoidable conduct by the ski area. So what's wrong with this bill is that it does what the Supreme Court said should not be done. It allows them to do just that through releases. They can require releases of liability, and this is where the bill is totally blatant. Releases of liability of claims for unreasonable conditions created by the operator. Unreasonable conditions. They're required to release that in order to use the facility. This legislation says that such a release is not unconscionable or contrary to public policy, and a unanimous decision of the Supreme Court has just said that indeed it is unconscionable and contrary to public policy. The inherent risks of skiing are redefined to include freestyle terrain, which is defined to include constructed runs, constructed artifacts that can be unreasonably constructed. It takes out the word posted from the idea that skiers shall familiarize themselves with information about the difficulty of the slope. It used to say posted information. They don't have to post it anymore. They're taking out that word, but requires that the skiers familiarize themselves with the degree of difficulty of a freestyle terrain. And how are they, before skiing, and how are they supposed to do that without skiing? So it doesn't make any sense on its surface to place those burdens without posted information. No, they're trying to obviate themselves of any responsibility to communicate to the skiers. Skiers still have to notify skiers of their statutory duties, but skiers are now also presumed to know those without such notification. So if they don't notice, they don't give notice of those statutory duties, it doesn't make any difference because the skiers are presumed to know them. So we get down to the fact that it's sort of like what Justice Bomber said in the middle of argument on the Bagley case. And he asked Mr. Balliat, he said, wasn't there a problem in Kosovo with the design of a snowboarding run? Wasn't there a problem there? And they refused to use it. The participants did until it was fixed because it was too dangerous, because it was a design error. And he said, and are you trying to say that the ski areas shouldn't be responsible if they do that and don't fix it? And I think that's the question that has to be asked here. I'm going to point out, finally, that the Delury case, which the Supreme Court talks about, I urge you to read the opinion. It doesn't take a long time, and it talks about a lot of these same issues. The Delury case in Vermont that said we're not going to allow releases was in 1995, and they did in Vermont what Bagley did in this state. And I have yet to hear that in the 20 subsequent years, the ski industry in Vermont has completely failed, which is what they're saying is going to happen here. And I don't believe it, and I suggest that the committee shouldn't believe it either. Thank you, and I urge you to vote no on this bill.
Thank you. Art.
Senator Perzanski and members of the committee. My name is Art Johnson. I'm a lawyer in Eugene. I graduated from law school in 1953 and have practiced law ever since in Eugene, with the exception of the time I was called to active duty in the Air Force for Korea. And in my practice, almost all of that time, I've represented plaintiffs, people that have suffered injury from some fault of someone else. Every one of those cases, and tort law in general, is important in that it's the most effective regulatory system we have for safety. Every case I handle, or my office handles or have ever handled, has two goals. We want to get fair compensation if our client was injured by somebody who was at fault, that is, was negligent, was guilty of something. But with that is a goal to prevent the same kind of injury from happening to the next person, whether it's to get a drunk off the road or to get an automobile recalled or something else. I can tell you some dramatic cases I did. One was I sued the city and county of San Francisco because of gross police misconduct. It resulted in a total reform of the police system in that area. And handbooks, everything, their training was changed, and it was essential, and it was for safety. I've been involved in a multitude of cases, probably hundreds involving products, and we don't win those cases unless the product is dangerously defective. And if it's dangerously defective, it should be removed or it should be redesigned. Sometimes we've helped in the redesign. When you come to this, The ski industry in Oregon doesn't have any undue burden with the present law. And that law, I remember well when that was hammered out, and some of the leaders were Ted Kulongoski and Dave Frohnmayer. I notice in the legislative history, Thorne, Lombard, Hurd. I can't remember all of the others that were involved in that. But that wasn't just casually passed. It was passed after a lot of modifications, a lot of amendments, a lot of thought, a lot of analysis. And it was agreed that if a skier is injured because of the inherent risk in that sport that that skier is willing to undertake, that skier doesn't have any claim against the ski area and shouldn't. And in the last month, I've met with two people who had serious injuries in the ski area, and I told them both that, no, I can't prosecute a claim for you because your claim was the result of an inherent risk of skiing. In effect, you've assumed that risk. And those cases are never going to be in a court. But I've also represented people who were injured because a ski area was negligent. And to say that you start one of these lawsuits by filing an affidavit and getting expert witness is an insult to our entire judiciary. You must prove by clear and convincing evidence on most of these issues. In any way, you must prove by the greater weight of evidence that someone was negligent. So why, I ask, should the ski industry in Oregon be free of or not have the same standard all the rest of us have? I drove from Eugene today in my automobile, and I had to exercise reasonable care, as every one of you do when you're driving a car. You must exercise reasonable care not to avoid it, not to hurt somebody else. We ride an aircraft, and the operators of that airplane have to exercise reasonable care. Almost anything you do, your duty is the duty like it's to your neighbor to exercise reasonable care. If they don't exercise reasonable care, if they are negligent and they cause harm to my child or my grandchild, I think it's fair that that child has a remedy. Now, in the ski area here, I have clear memories of the passage of the present ski statute, as I said, and it was hammered out. And the ski area wanted some protection, and they got exactly what they wanted. And I Keith Petrie, who was manager of Molapur Ski Bowl and was representing his company as well as other skiing organizations in the state of the time, repeatedly said in hearings that the ski industry still wanted to be responsible, and he repeatedly said that they did not want to duck their responsibilities, that they would continue to be responsible where they were at fault for an injury, but they shouldn't have to defend themselves if the injury was not their fault, if it was an inherent risk of skiing. I've had a few injuries myself skiing. I've skied longer than I've been a lawyer by many years, and those were from inherent risk of skiing. And but if I ride on a chairlift, or if I had one case I might say against Mount Bachelor, I've turned some down, as I said. I had one case that actually went to trial, and there was no question that just where the lift ended and there was a wall of snow and you had to turn right suddenly or turn left suddenly to get out of the way of the next chair that was coming. And between two rides, this ski patrol, which is usually an excellent ski patrol over there, I have great respect for them, but that time somebody closed off the turn to the left, so with two just laying two bobsleds on the snow. So three women who were riding a chair had gone that way on the last run. They turned their way again, and wham, within 10 feet they ran into, and one of them got a serious knee injury. Well, isn't it fair in that circumstance that somebody made that kind of a mistake that caused an unnecessary injury be compensated? And when you've accomplished that, the ski area then is going to be more careful in the future to prevent such injuries from happening again. And I just say that the law that was passed in 79 was hammered out with great thought, great care. It has worked. Ski industries have prospered in Oregon, and they don't need to be insulated against any claim whatsoever. It would be a terrible mistake for that to happen. As I say, the most important things of our whole tort system is that it does work to effect to accomplish safety. And if a truck has an accident for some reason, a helicopter falls out of the sky, it's a challenge to find out why that happened. And sometimes that involves hiring the best engineer or the best in the landslide, the best geomorphologist in the world, or finding honest experts that can really understand and analyze it. And then when you know what happened with that helicopter, or you know what happened with that chairlift, you can prevent it from happening again. But if you pass a law that they're asking for, all of us will have less protection, and everybody that skis in the future in Oregon will have less protection because the skier won't have the duty to exercise reasonable care. Thanks for listening to me.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Again, I'll ask if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 849. Not seeing anyone, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 849. For purposes that we have another bill that's scheduled, Senate Bill 577, I'll opening a public hearing. I do have people from the Department of Justice here that we're only going to testify if someone else showed up. So let me see if there's anyone who has not signed up for SB 577 that are here to testify today. Not seeing Aaron and Michael, did y'all not want to testify? Just want to clarify for the record.
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General's Office in the Oregon Department of Justice. Senate Bill 577 is not our bill. We see some merit in it, but if no one was stepping forward, we didn't think it was appropriate for us to step into their shoes.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 577 without really opening it, but we did open it for that purpose of getting that information. And I believe that's taken care of us now. What I'd like to do is, colleagues, we will be meeting tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. I will be trying to get back and talk to y'all between now and the end of the week as to other activities we'll be doing this week. So with that, we'll see everyone in the morning. 8 o'clock, and we're adjourned. Now, regarding those that are here for 849, I would like to talk to representatives on both sides just to get some clarity as to what the chair believes might be next steps.
When you said other activities, you mean
the chair believes might be next steps.
When you said other activities, you mean